Welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, January 22nd, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher Gunathchish. Hawa Toksik Nusum Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, 10 years of gaming and conventions with the folks from Platypus Gaming. We get the rundown on this weekend's board game extravaganza con happening at Centennial Hall. The Juno Symphony continues their search for a new music director. Today, we meet Wilbur Lynn and talk about this weekend's concert, Virtuosity. And Maggie McMillan from the Juno Chamber stops in to share the organization's top priorities for 2025. Those conversations, plus a new segment from Native Voice One, Our Living Lands, coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the shoe ye, we kashuk a ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin talk anachaya ha anikach, gunish cheese.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. You're listening to Community Supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher. The folks over at Platypus Gaming are celebrating this weekend. It's the 10th annual Platypus Con board and card game extravaganza. It begins Friday, January 24th, and continues through the weekend at Centennial Hall. With a library of over 2,600 games, there is literally something for everyone. I am joined now in studio by one of the folks responsible for amassing such a large collection of games to tell us more about this weekend's festivities. Josh Warren Gunathchish, Ha Yigudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. Wasa Iti, how's it going?
It's always great to be here. It's going fantastic.
Awesome. So I want to get into first the history. It's 10 years. Congratulations on the Platypus Con. But tell us about how Platypus Gaming came about.
So I went to Gen Con, which is probably the U.S.'s biggest convention, and I really dug the atmosphere and like getting to meet other people to play games with. But it is expensive, and for some people, prohibitively so. So I wanted to bring something similar to Juno. So we started 10 years ago, very small. We were only using the Jack that year, and now we're using all of Centennial. So.
Nice. So you started Platypus Gaming specifically to have the con?
Yeah, just okay. To have an event where people can give me an excuse to buy too many games and also meet new friends to play games with. Because we do run into a lot of people who haven't developed a friend group to play board games with, and I'm happy when somebody finds one to mesh with.
That's right. It's funny because I've been down at Alaska and Robotics, and once in a while I'll see a game they make them for solo now too, because they know that folks, you can play it solo or with friends, some of these games, which is kind of cool. So if you're not into socializing, but of course, playing board games with people and having that fun is, that's kind of a big deal, I think.
Yeah, I'm not the best at just like random social interaction, but if you give me a board game where we can talk about other stuff at the same time, I'm much more comfortable.
Right, there's something happening as opposed to like we're just staring at each other waiting for the conversation to begin.
Yeah, I'm always like the silence hits and I'm always worried. So.
Yeah. So that's cool. So that's awesome. So did you imagine when you started that you would be hitting the 10th anniversary?
I mean, I was optimistic. I did call, some of my friends thought I was a little crazy. I was called the first annual when we did it 10 years ago, sort of advertising that we're going to keep doing this thing. But I've always been, every year I'm worried that it's not going to work, and then it does.
Nice.
So it's getting harder to convince myself it's not going to work because we've been doing it so well for so long. But the first year was definitely, what if nobody shows up?
And you have done other things now throughout the year. Like I know when we have the Juno Library in here, you sort of do a monthly thing with them to have people come and you show them how to play the games and get interested in it. You do that out at the Mendenhall Library?
The libraries we do the last Sunday, and we alternate between the Valley and Douglas.
Okay.
So we can, some people, it's a long drive, a long, quote unquote long drive for some people to go to either branch. We also do Monday nights now in the lower level of Devil's Club.
Oh, nice.
So that's been pretty popular as well.
Okay, cool. So if people can't make it to the con, there still is stuff happening all throughout the year. To get connected with this, platypusgaming.org is where you can find out information. Do you guys have like a Facebook page and stuff too?
We do. We try to keep it fairly active, especially close to the con, but that's what we're hoping to do. And we will have like a newsletter sign up on our webpage soon. And if you come to the con, there will be like a link for it. So we're trying to make it easier to tell people what's happening.
Okay.
It can be hard.
So before we get into like the details of what's happening at the con, can you just give us the rundown of the dates and times and such that people need to know about and how to get tickets?
Totally. So we start this Friday at 6 p.m. and we go until Sunday at 6 p.m. with some sleep breaks in between in there. You can definitely get tickets at our website, which is platypusgaming.org. We have adult tickets weekend and single day, kid weekend and single day. And this year we have like a family bundle because we want to try to encourage families to come. And you can also get them at the door. So
very cool. And I don't think I've asked this before, but where did the name Platypus Gaming come from?
Platypus is my favorite animal, and I didn't want it to be named something generic like JunoCon.
It works because it's definitely an intriguing name. It gets people going, what's that all about? Platypus Gaming, which is kind of fun. So, all right, let's talk about the con itself. I know that you have a special guest this year. Tell us a little bit about that.
So we've tried guests a couple times, and this time we're having John DeClaire, who a lot of designers will design sort of very similar games, and I'm very impressed with the breadth of game design he has. He has very simple games to complicated games. I'm not sure if there's a game type he hasn't designed. And we're not really having him do much other than come and play games with play his games with people here. And I know there's some people at one of the other local stores that like one of their favorite games is his game, and they're really looking forward to playing it with him.
And I know one of his games is Mystic Veil, and he has some expansions for that, right?
There's a whole bunch of expansions. Mystic Veil. Mystic Veil is a great game. Space Base is another one. And there's like Ready, Set, Bet, which is literally just placing bets on a fake horse race with some strategy involved. But so you can go from Mystic Veil is not terribly complicated, but it's more complicated than Ready, Set, Bet.
I see. Okay. And it's cool because I noticed in his bio, too, that he has a lot of his games. You know, we may have backed him. You may have backed them on Kickstarter, and you don't even know it, that it's maybe his game, because there's games on Kickstarter all the time that are being created, and that's kind of a cool place to support people in creating some of these independent games.
Yeah, I really dig that the industry as a whole has definitely moved towards naming designers more than it was when I was a kid. Like, there's some games I played as a kid, Monopoly included, where it's just made by the company. You don't know who put the work into making that design work.
Yeah, who's responsible, right? It's nice to know that, especially because there's artwork involved. There's, like, game design. There's, like, putting it together, like, the rule set, all that stuff that makes the games fun. And it's nice if you liked one game and you go, oh, this person made this new game. I'm going to give it a shot because it's kind of like actors in movies. You go see, you know, the latest whatever film because so-and-so's in it. And same thing with games, I would think, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, like, you can definitely, like, there are definitely some designers where I'm probably going to buy without looking terribly hard.
Right.
Because I'm like, oh, they designed it. It's probably going to be good. And speaking of the artists, like, I also think that they're crediting the artists because this year we got 3 commissioned pieces from various board game artists
to do a
platypus-related art piece for us. And we'll have them hang in the hallways and also have them in the store.
So. Oh, that's nice. That's so fun. Okay, and then I want to talk about these tournaments that are happening, because not only do you have, like, on this page, platypusgaming.org/tournaments, there's going to be all kinds of tournaments. And, I mean, there's a long list here. And it's like there is the possibility that when you win the tournament here in Juneau, that you can go to a national convention as, like, the representative from Juno or from this con, or how does that work exactly?
Totally. Most of them, not the kid ones, but the Puggle tournaments. But I think all of the tournaments that are open to everyone, are a qualifier for some regional convention, either Gen Con or GameStorm, and then Catan is Gen Con. So they're very, you have to go to various different conventions to do, but this is essentially a regional qualifier. So you, if you win, you get like a guaranteed seat and a free badge to the convention.
I see. So this gets you to the regional, which then if you go there and you do well, then maybe there's the national.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. And what are some of the games that you're going to be having tournaments with this year?
We have Rebel Princess, which if you've ever played Hearts, it's very, very similar. So you can definitely jump right in. Shobu is probably a close second to Catan. It's a very simple little stone rock game, and it's been very popular because it's very simple to learn. We do try to keep the tournaments to be games that are very easy to grasp so that we have more attachment. So, and we're happy to teach you before the tournament if you don't know and want to learn before you get into a tournament.
So something like Shobu, is it one of those things like poker where it's like easy to learn but hard to master?
Yeah, generally I only win when I'm teaching people. once you've sort of figured out the game, I'm probably going to do poorly. So that's why I like teaching new people.
Got to have some competition that you can beat, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of fun. That's cool. And they happen throughout the weekend, right? There's going to be a whole schedule of when those are happening.
Yeah, we'd really encourage if you come to check out the program. The program will have information on everything, including the tournaments.
Right, okay. You also have just regular, looks like card game qualifiers, like hearts and spades and stuff?
Yeah, those will be later in the evening, I think.
Okay, yeah, because the one cool thing about this con is that it goes late. Like, you can be there till 2 a.m.
Yeah, we're going to start pushing at 1:45 because you need to be out by 2. But, yes, we...
I'm sure the Centennial staff is like, let's go, boys.
Let's out. Go. Let's go. If you stay long enough, you'll get to hear the song collection that we play to assist people in leaving.
Nice. Okay, so. And you mentioned Puggle. What is a Puggle?
Puggle is a name for baby platypus. So... that's the name we gave for the tournaments that are only open to our attendees who are between 5 and 12.
Oh, nice.
So that they can play with people their own age and not get walloped by an adult. So
that's really cool. Okay. And I have to say, I was telling you this before we went on air, but I find it amazing how many games Platypus Gaming owns. And there is a database on your website that people can look up. And right now it says there's 2,606 games in this database. And then you can pare it down. On the left side, there's categories like, oh, single player or multiplayer, whatever it is, like different things, subjects you're interested in, whatever, you can sort of narrow it down. And these are physical games that you and your collective degenerates own?
Yeah, we have all of them. We keep them generally in storage in between, and we'll go and get the odd game. But it's definitely become, it used to be stored in our garages, and now it's just gotten too big. I think when we started, we had maybe 500 games.
Now tell me that because you're a con, that the companies who make these games are supplying them to you, or is this money for these games coming out of your pocket?
I'm a dink, so it's generally my pocket, but I'm happy to do it. So... We get the odd donation, but normally the donations we get are generally sent straight to our play-to-win table, which is the biggest it's been. I really wanted to make sure we had 100 different games to play to win this year for our 10th, and I evidently didn't keep good accounting because now we have over 150 to give away. So.
And explain play-to-win.
So when you come to the con, you can just any of the games from the play-to-win table, plural this time. You can play the game, and then there's a code inside the lid that takes you to the a very similar webpage to our library, and you just fill out a form. And at the end of the con, we draw random names for each of the games, and somebody who played it and did that link takes it home.
Very cool. Like, this thing is massive. It's going to be happening all this weekend. It starts Friday at 6 o'clock,
yep.
And Friday night you go till 2 a.m., on Saturday, you start a little bit earlier. What time do you start on Saturday?
10 a.m.
10 a.m., and then it goes till 2 a.m.
Yep.
And then Sunday, you start again at 10 and go till 6.
You know, have to have some sleep sometime.
Have to sleep in there somewhere. Everybody's got to go back to work on Monday and such. Okay, one more time, Josh, can you give us the details, dates, and when, where we can get tickets and stuff?
So this Friday, the 24th, all the way through the 26th, you can get tickets at platypusgaming.org or at the door. Either works. Doing it online will make your life a little bit easier to start out with, but we're really looking forward to seeing everyone there.
Awesome. That sounds so good. And there's so many things. You can go on the website. You can get a list of all the things that are happening. There's a schedule on there. You can see what's coming up, the different games that are available this weekend. There's some that are the demos also that you'll be having. You'll be showing people games, and those are broken down by day. Certain days will be certain demos of games, which is kind of cool. It's just a full weekend of gaming, which is just really fun. And we're talking about physical board games and card games, not the video kind, although those are awesome too.
Yeah, I mean, I really dig them, but yeah, this one is focused on sitting down at a table with some friends and playing a game.
I love it. Well, thank you, Josh, for coming in. Gun the Cheese for being here. PlatypusGaming.org for more information.
Yeah, thanks.
We'll take a break, and up next, we'll talk with the Juno Symphony about the next candidate in the musical director search and what they have on deck for this weekend's Virtuosity concert. But first, a new segment from Native Voice One called Our Living Lands. It's a 5-minute weekly segment that explores the impact of climate change on the health, culture, and environment in indigenous communities from Alaska to Florida. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The devastation in and around Los Angeles is a reminder that extreme wildfires burn year-round. That's why the Washoe Tribe of Nevada and California is working to reintroduce intentional cultural fire meant to restore forest health. In the first installment of a 3-part series on indigenous fire, the Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
It's a sun-splashed afternoon in a forest near South Lake Tahoe, where large fir and pine trees stretch into the clear blue sky. Here, there are dozens of tribal members eager to learn about cultural burning. But first, they have to learn how to control and put out fires. That's why a group is huddled around a heavy-duty water pump, with 2 thick fire hoses connected to it. One is in a tub of water, the size of an above-ground pool, and the other is unraveled a few dozen yards away. Jeremy Miles Placencia is with the U.S. Forest Service and leading the demonstration.
We have everything connected. We have our discharge hose. Now we can set up the fuel line.
And then he revs up the water pump. Water pushes through the extended hose like a snake coming to life. Now participants can practice spraying pressurized water as if they were putting out a fire. One person soaking up that knowledge is 30-year-old Kyle Tabor Cooper. He's a member of the Nooksack tribe in Washington State, but lives in northern Nevada and is engaged to a member of the Washoe tribe.
I've met a lot of people that have inspired me to like get into this training and just show me like a different kind of way, like with cultural intentional fire.
Cultural fires are restorative, not destructive. They're typically done on a smaller scale to take care of traditional medicine plants or other cultural resources that rely on fire.
So for example, the Washoe tribe, our first 2 burns were burning a willow patch.
That's Rihanna Jones, the director of the Washoe tribe's Environmental Protection Department.
Washoes are famous for their baskets, making beautiful baskets. So when you burn the willows, they grow back better, straighter, with less secondary nodes.
But the Washoe tribe wasn't allowed to burn for more than a century. That's because of longtime colonial federal policies that prioritize suppression or putting out fires as soon as they start. Jones says that has hurt tribes and the health of many forests.
Fire suppression is like indigenous culture and indigenous people suppression as well. You know, they were not interested in, I think, learning from indigenous people.
But that has started to change over the last decade. Now, many federal fire officials say decades of keeping fire off the land caused a buildup of highly flammable dead trees and brush, turning many forests into a tinderbox. And rising temperatures and drier conditions are adding even more fuel. A 2021 study led by UCLA found that climate change has been the main driver of the increase of fire weather in the West.
Climate change has had a huge effect with respect to drought, increase of pests and pathogens, and then increase of wildfire. So we're having these catastrophic huge wildfires coming through that we can't keep up with.
Global nonprofit The Nature Conservancy has worked with tribes to help restore that balance. The group brings together trained burn bosses and indigenous fire practitioners to work and learn side by side. Brandon Cobb is Cherokee and a program manager with the conservation group, which was here at this training.
A lot of what we're doing here is trying to return to that different style of fire that allows us to actually promote our ecosystems, promote our cultures.
He says that's why it's important that younger generations become educated and trained on stewarding their homelands.
As indigenous people, it took almost 500 years to nearly eradicate us. And in order to rebuild to what we once were, it will take at least 500 years.
Back near the water pump, Tabor Cooper is motivated to be a part of that change.
I feel like there's a lot of purpose in this kind of line of work.
Through this hands-on training, Tabor Cooper gained qualifications to fight fires with federal and state agencies and the Washoe tribe, and work on cultural burns with tribal members. He's already gotten a taste of what it's like. He recently observed a cultural burn in a meadow to restore medicinal plants like elderberries, an experience that inspired him even more.
The possibilities and like the opportunity and like what the future holds like seems so much brighter. Introducing a relationship with fire that isn't just bad.
Tabor Cooper says he's excited to carve out a career in fire and pass that knowledge down to future generations. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caleb Radel.
Next week, you'll hear about a tribe working to build its capacity to conduct burns on their ancestral lands. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's breathtaking. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. That is a piece you will hear this weekend from the Juno Symphony when they present Virtuosity, a concert featuring Mozart, Beethoven, and this piece. And we will find out the name of this piece in just a second. It's Saturday, January 25th, and Sunday, January 26th at JDHS, Yedda Akathle Auditorium. For more information, you can visit junosymphony.org. And by attending, you'll also get a chance to see the second candidate of four that the symphony is hosting this season in their search for a new musical director. This weekend, Wilbur Lynn is conducting, and I welcome Wilbur and Charlotte Truitt, executive director of the symphony, to the studio now. Gunathchish, Haye Adi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you both in the studio. Wasiati, how's it going?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, of course. Welcome to Juno, Wilbur.
Yeah.
Have you been to Juno before?
First time here. First time in Alaska, actually.
Oh, wow. First time to Alaska.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're still hearing a little bit of this piece.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what this is?
This is the hauntingly beautiful second movement of Joaquin Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez. It's a guitar concerto.
Oh, man, it's so good. Like, it's just one of those things. And that will be playing this weekend. He was a famous Spanish
composer of the early 20th century.
Early 20th century. And it's the first time, Charlotte, that this piece will be heard in Juno?
Yes, we get to premiere the piece here in Juno. And we're just so thrilled to have John Unzicker playing this concerto. And it's something that he and I began talking about this in 21 during the pandemic. He had done a piece with a quartet in one of our virtual concerts that KTOO filmed at the Mindenhall Glacier. And afterwards I said, John, when we get out of all this, you need to be on the main stage with the full orchestra. And what would you be interested in doing? And he said, I've got this concerto you should listen to. And so from that time on, we have been eagerly awaiting the right time when this could happen. And it's this weekend. And I don't know, I think that second movement is probably one of the most beautiful pieces of music ever written. It is fantastic.
Yeah, we were listening to it and it was just like, ooh. It
takes your breath away,
right? It does,
right?
It really does. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's just
so
wonderful.
Charlotte, tell us a little bit about, just give us the details of this weekend's concert, times, and all that good stuff, and where we can get more information.
Right. Well, information, you can find all of that on our website, junosymphony.org. The concerts this weekend are Saturday night at 7:30. We do want to talk a little bit about our pre-concert talk. That's 1 hour before each performance. And you'll get to hear Will Berlin talk about the concert, give you a little more information about the program, and kind of help inform your listening for the evening. So it's always really interesting, and it'd be another opportunity to get to know Wilbur. So that is at 6:30 Saturday night, followed by the concert at 7:30. Mm-hmm. Then on Sunday, the pre-concert talk is at 2 o'clock, and the concert is at 3. Also, we like to work with our community partners, and this time we like to support our young people. At this concert weekend, we're working with JAM, and they're doing the bake sale for during intermission, so we want folks to support those young people with JAM, buying their goodies, and then also before the concert, between the concert talk and the actual concert, the students will be playing in the lobby. So we'll have their mariachi band, their young guitarists playing on Saturday night, and then their advanced string players will be playing on Sunday. So come early and enjoy everything that is involved with the Juno Symphony concert evening or afternoon.
And I know you can get tickets, of course, at junosymphony.org. But you also, I remember I volunteered previously to be an usher. Are you still doing that program?
Yes, we still have volunteers that really, you know, I think all of us nonprofits survive with the help and the work of the volunteers. And we have about 45 volunteers who come alongside and help us in all aspects of the productions. We try to show our thanks to those folks with complimentary seating and also invitations to our after parties. Our musicians like to hang out together after the weekend, and we do a nice little after party, and volunteers are invited. So if you're looking for a place to volunteer, the Juno Symphony is always looking for more volunteers.
And you can reach out on the contact information on the website and stuff like that, which is really great. Okay, so this is a concert. It's a season, but it's also a search this year.
Yes.
And it's a long search. It's one of those things that takes a while because, you know, I feel worst for the first candidate because they have to wait the longest. But Wilbur, you're the second candidate, so you have to wait a little bit longer. But that is interesting. But I am curious, Charlotte, when narrowing down to the four candidates that you chose to perform this season or conduct this season, what are some of the qualities that you want for the symphony, for the symphony members? What do you want from the conductor for the symphony members?
Right. Well, you know, the conductor wears many hats, and he's got a lot of different audiences that he works with. He works with the musicians, he works with the board, he works with the staff, and works with the audience and with our education outreach program. So it's very multifaceted. So I think the job of the music director and conductor goes way beyond just what people see when the conductor's actually doing the concert. And so we're looking for someone who can really connect with the musicians, connect with the audience, and then the community at large. And I know that's one of Wilbur's real desires, is to cultivate community within the arts and also encourage the new next generation of music lovers. And so we're always looking to do that. And also, you know, finding someone who really can enter in and be a part of this great arts community within Juno.
Yeah, education is such a big piece, and Juno is such a tight-knit community that it'll be interesting to see who gets chosen and how they integrate into the community here. So, Wilbur, let's talk a little bit about you, and then we'll talk a little bit about the program that we're going to hear. Will you share a little bit about your background? I know your bio is really extensive. You can see the whole thing at junosymphony.org. They have the long bio, but will you give us sort of the background of your musical history?
Sure. Yeah. No. So I am a pianist. I started when I was pretty young, like a lot of, you know, Asian pianists. We all start very young. But I decided that I wanted to conduct when I was in high school. I was helping my band teacher, and I decided that, hey, this is something that I really love to do. I joke about that, you know, I don't like to practice. It's easier to conduct. And that's actually partially true. But the other part is that, you know, I want to be in a big ensemble. I want to feel the sound that I can really be part of. And, you know, there preciously few piano parts in major orchestral pieces. So I decided that I want to be a conductor.
I see.
And I'm pretty lucky that I, you know, started on this journey and get to conduct in many different countries, many different states, and lived in 7 different states in the past 10 years.
Wow.
And working with different orchestras.
That's a lot. What age did you start?
So I started learning the piano when I was 5. High school is when I wanted to conduct. That's about that time.
Okay. Yeah. I was just curious about the piano because I know that, like,
when you start young like that, it becomes like a life journey, really. Yeah. Like it gets ingrained in your bones. Did your parents play?
They all play a little bit of piano, and my dad was our church choir director. He was not a professional musician, but it's fairly musical in the family, I would say.
I see. Okay. And what was it about classical music that sort of got into your bones? What was the thing? Was there a certain piece, or was there a style or something?
There was actually a certain piece. It was actually one of my first experiences to hear a professional symphony when I was in high school. And I heard Ravila Mussorgsky's picture at an exhibition. And it was around that time that, you know, I was in band, and I know classical music to a certain degree, but I never really studied a piece. And the town I grew up in did not have a professional symphony, so when a symphony was coming, I was like, okay, I'm going to the concert, and how about I listen to this piece? And at first I didn't get, you know, the piece, what it's about, and the style and everything, but I just listened to it again and again and realized that, oh my God, there are so many things in a piece like this. And when I got to the concert, and I was just overwhelmed with the soundscape, with just the emotions coming in from an amazing piece like that.
Yeah, and so I guess as a player, you are one part of that sound, and then as the conductor, you sort of are swept up in it. You're responsible for it, but you also get to be sort of in the eye of the tornado, as it were.
Yeah,
right?
Like, yeah, I have the best seat in the house, that's what I tell people.
I guess the eye of the hurricane, not the tornado. You don't want to be in that.
I don't think you don't want to be in either, you want to be in the eye of the music. That's correct, yes.
For sure. Okay, so you currently work with a couple of other symphonies.
Yeah.
You work in Missouri and Colorado. So I'm curious, what's the drive or desire you have to add Alaska to the list? Or does one of those get kicked out if you get this gig?
No. So conductors, we move orchestras every 5 to 10 years. So we're always on the look. And symphonies are actually always on the look as well, because every conductor has a 5 to 8 year contract at most. And then, people want to work with different people. So we're always on the move. We're always looking to form new collaborators to work with. And the story with Juno is actually pretty interesting, because I believe the time I applied was 2014 or something around that time.
Oh.
And the symphony graciously just kept my resume on the file. And haven't heard about and thought about Juno until Charlotte reached out last year and got back in touch.
Checked in on you and said, what are you doing, Wilbur? You want to come to Alaska? You want to audition?
And the answer
for a gig?
Is obviously yes. I would want to come to Alaska, yes.
Of course. So it is curious, because I come from the theater, and I heard once that there's something about like an artistic director or something like a music director, that really it's a 10-year or so span, because the vision, you want new vision coming in, and you want new people's perspective and things like that. So that's kind of cool. I'm curious, how do you juggle all of those commitments to different places like Colorado and Missouri? How do you manage that in your own life?
Yeah, so it's always a mix of trying to make everything work. And the good thing is a musician's schedule, especially in the classical music world, we look, 2-3 years ahead. So I'm programming my 2026-2027 season and trying to figure out where the pieces lie. So that makes things easier in terms of that you have enough time to figure things out. And I don't know how many of the titles that I have I will still have at that time. Maybe everything, but maybe some will drop out and we'll make room for other things. So it's this process of finding, who do you want to work with in 2-3 years?
Right.
And it's the same on Juno Symphony's end. Where does the symphony want to go, and who does the symphony want to be?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it seems like preparation is key. Mm-hmm. Like even having, I think it was Michael Kaiser who used to work at the Kennedy Center and was a big arts administrator person, used to keep a list on his desk of like the next 5 years, and things would get crossed out and then added and moved around and changed. But it can't be last minute, because obviously scheduling, when those weekends are going to be happening, rehearsals with the orchestra, those kinds of things. So where do you call home?
Currently, Denver, Colorado.
Denver, Colorado. Okay. So that's home at the moment.
Yes.
Okay, I see. So then
then this is I'm curious because we mentioned the community, and Charlotte said you have an interest in community mm-hmm. and making that happen. How do you then embed yourself in the culture and the community of these places mm-hmm. that you work?
Yeah. So first of all, I try to be physically there at wherever orchestra I'm working with as much as possible, even if I'm not conducting. If I have a week free, then I'll be like, oh, I haven't been, you know, to this community in a little while. How about I go there and do meetings and just be there and meet people? That's one of the things. And the other thing is that I have four different subscriptions to local papers around the places that I work with because I want to get the notifications. I want to know what the school board's doing. I want to know where everyone's thinking and what the big event was and kind of tap into the zeitgeist of that local region. That's kind of what I wanted to do. Yeah.
Awesome. Hashtag not a job interview.
Right.
I feel like I'm grilling you on the questions. But I love that because it is interesting to think about someone who comes into our town
yeah.
and is creating music or picking a program and what do they know about the community that we're in and mm-hmm. how are they going to program for that community.
Yeah.
But, not that it's impossible not living here, but
right.
like at least being in touch with subscribing to the newspaper, whatever
yeah.
that might be.
Yeah.
And obviously you have Charlotte as your executive director who
yeah.
keeps everything right. moving along as well. Okay, so let's talk about this program that's happening. Now, you don't pick the program because, like you said, these
mm-hmm.
programs are picked in advance,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes years in advance. So this was already the program, and you were assigned to it. What
yes.
did you think when you were assigned, you know, Beethoven's Seventh, the Marriage of Figaro Overture, and then this awesome piece by Rodrigo?
Yeah, yeah. So when this program was presented to me, I was actually just excited to see it. You know, obviously, if you're a contact, you're asked to conduct a concert, your answer was, yes, I want to do it. But I actually really want to do it. you know, Beethoven 7 is something that I probably did four times in the past three seasons. So that's something I do a lot, Marriage of Figaro Overture as well. But the Rodrigo piece has been on my list for quite a while. It's a beautiful piece. You don't get to do a lot. There aren't that many guitar solos in the world who travels with it. I mean, it's one of the most famous guitar concertos, but you don't have that many guitar concerto soloists to work with. So when this opportunity presented itself, just by this piece alone, I want to do it.
Nice. I'm going to play a little bit of this Beethoven 7th, just to, as we complete our conversation today. You'll be hearing this this weekend with Will Berlin conducting. He's the second of four music director candidates. And you'll also be hearing Mozart's Overture to the Marriage of Figaro. That's a shorter piece, right? That's you're
mm-hmm.
opening with
that's
that,
four
I would
minutes.
Assume.
Yeah, that's very short.
It's like to get people jazzed up and
exactly.
going, right? And then you're playing the
concerto,
the guitar concerto, and then you'll be finishing with the full Beethoven 7th Symphony.
Exactly.
That's awesome. Now, Charlotte, last question for you.
Sure.
When you're picking the program or when the previous music director was picking these programs, do they think about, obviously they do, but are they looking for things that will challenge the symphony members?
Yes, certainly. We want music that's going to challenge and be interesting for the musicians and also be attractive for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I think we really learned through the pandemic, without the audience, there are no performances. You know,
mm-hmm.
we have rehearsals, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to try to find the balance there and what's going to challenge the musicians and be really engaging for the audience. And I think everything on this program, everything in this season, fits that bill. I think people will be very pleased with the variety and the breadth of music that we have throughout this year. And in this concert as well, it's just, this is one of those, you're going to feel good in the midwinter, in the dark of the midwinter.
Mm-hmm.
Come on out, get your soul warmed up with this concert. I think it's just, it's lovely. It is a little bit smaller of an orchestra than what people normally see with us. Sometimes we have 63 to 65 players.
Mm-hmm.
This was by design, a more intimate, smaller, reduced size
mm-hmm.
orchestra. So I think we have 48 on the roster, 44, 48, something
mm-hmm.
like that. And it's just the strings are really going to shine. The woodwinds are really going to shine in
mm-hmm.
this concert. We have less brass this time, but this is a beautiful program.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to have their spirits lifted. And in the dark of winter, we need this right now. And we just want everyone to come out and enjoy it. We're offering free student seating, so get those children out there in the auditorium
mm-hmm.
and also pay-as-you-can seating on Sunday. So we want to encourage everyone to come and enjoy the symphony. And if you haven't come before, come on out. You know, there's a lot of families that identify with John because he was a school teacher, or he's still a school teacher. Mm-hmm. He's been doing it for 20 years in the Juneau School District. And many people know and love John. And like Wilbur said, this is a rare opportunity. I mean, he said, this is the piece every guitar player wants the chance to get to play, to like, that is the pinnacle, you know. He's like, this is I've reached the top, this is a dream come true. And yeah. So I really hope that the community will come out in support of the symphony and of John and his great work on this concerto.
That's awesome. Yeah, John Unziger will be playing that concerto this weekend. So one more time, Charlotte, give us the details, dates, times, and where we can get tickets.
Sure. Tickets are at junosymphony.org. Concerts are Saturday night at 7:30, Sunday at 3. And come early to hear the pre-concert talks 1 hour before each performance. And let's all support the jam program as well and those young artists that will be playing in the lobby right before the concert.
Awesome. Well, Wilbur, it was great to meet you.
Yeah, likewise.
Have an awesome time this weekend with the Juneau Symphony. Really appreciate you both coming in today. Gunnath Cheesh.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk with Maggie from the Juneau Chamber about 2025 priorities. But first, here's a savory moment on Juneau Afternoon from KTOO.
Step in to the savory moment. Cabbage is often paired with hearty meat and seafood entrees. Think smoked herring and sauerkraut or barbecue pork with coleslaw. But usually it's the meat or fish that stars in the show. The following dramatization, based loosely on an anecdote from Chef Michael Anthony in the book The Flavor Bible, breaks that cardinal rule. It's Monday morning at the Gramercy Tavern in New York City, and the week's produce order has arrived. A crew of white-aproned chefs gather to see what is about to fill their refrigerated coffers. Nubbly spheres of celery root, licorice-scented fronds of fennel. Actually, it's cabbage. The room is so quiet, you can hear a meat thermometer drop. Each cook wrestles separately with the task of creating a new recipe for the menu board. One chef heats the oven for roasting. Another pulls out the robo-coup for slaw. Chef Michael Anthony heats a skillet. Hot. Way too hot. Meanwhile, he begins to chiffonade. Chef Michael throws cabbage slivers in the hot skillet, and a sweet, earthy smoke begins to fill the kitchen, drawing a loud scolding from the chef de cuisine, the big boss. Nevertheless, everyone places a crinkly brown ribbon of cabbage on their tongue. Hey, this is good. Add caraway, the sous chef shouts. Walnuts, says the chef de partie. Deglaze, pronounces the chef de cuisine, with calvados. A splash of olive oil, and all agree this is a nice, easy marriage and a wildly popular addition to the menu board. Gramercy loves their Arctic char, but Alaskans will enjoy this cabbage dish with wild salmon. Find the full recipe for easy marriage cabbage salad at savorymoment.org from the studios of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska. I'm Beth Shortroads. Whatever is on your dinner table tonight, may you savor the moment.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Idi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Tune in for our second biannual Radio Theater Festival this January 31st through February 2nd, featuring six original plays by Alaska writers, including Frank Henry Koshkatas, Dave Hunsaker, Mary Ellefson, and Hedy Laverne. Plays will be performed before a studio audience and broadcast simultaneously on KTOO-FM. The festival is co-produced by Theater Alaska and KTOO in association with Juno Ghostlight Theater. Tickets to be in the studio audience and a full festival rundown are at ktoo.org.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson right here at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Joining me now in the studio is Maggie McMillan, Executive Director of the Juno Chamber of Commerce. Happy New Year. Gonna cheese for being here. Hi.
It's great to see you. I feel like I haven't seen you in ages.
It's been a couple months. I think we missed December probably, and I don't even know if we did November, but it's been a couple months. But I'm happy to have you here, and it's 2025.
My son keeps telling me I'm from the 1900s now. So yes, it's just very
seems,
cool.
It seems weird to be saying that date over and over again, but you know, it's just it's wild. So before we get into some of the priorities, I just wanted you to let's just remind folks what is the Chamber of Commerce.
So chambers are different everywhere you go. And I try to explain that to people. But in Juno, we are the voice of the business community. We advocate. We provide networking opportunities. Our main goals are to convene the business community as much as we can, right? Well, we have lots of goals, but our mission, right? We're conveners. We serve to champion the community. And we are also a catalyst for change in the community. So a lot of times when people think of Chamber of Commerce, they think of business. And I think when you go over our priorities today, I think they'll realize that we're a community organization. Mm. I know that we have members that are business members and we are the voice of the business community, but the work that we do benefits Juno.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And, but the chamber it's a nonprofit group,
yep.
Right?
We are a 501c6.
C6, right,
yes.
Okay.
We do have a 501c3 that we also operate as the chamber, but we are 501c6.
I see.
So we are a nonprofit. We're more of a social organization. Think of it that way. But we do all the work that we do. Our sole mission is to benefit business community, but the work that we do has these unforeseen consequences that are lots of times good for everyone. You know, when we review a budget and we make it so your property taxes don't go up, that benefited the whole community, not
right.
just the business community.
Well, that's what I was thinking when I was looking at the priorities that you sent me, which are, I guess, are determined by the board of directors
yes.
of the Chamber of Commerce, which are probably made up the board of directors of
15 people, and they're all business owners.
Business owners. Mm-hmm. So it's their sort of idea of what's important for the business community here in Juno. And so that's just one thing to think about as you hear some of these priorities, is it's coming from that particular viewpoint, right?
Exactly.
And it's interesting because they're broken down, these priorities, into three main categories. And I guess we can start with the first one. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this one, but it is the government.
Oh, yeah.
Government's huge. We just started our legislative session yesterday.
Yep.
We have a new regime in the land of the United States. So lots of change. Things are happening. And so what are you looking at locally in terms of state and local government?
So we have different relationships with both. So for the state government, we follow certain bills. We work really closely with our local delegation. And we also host things like the legislative welcome, right? So all sorts of different hats for state government. City government is a lot more. We're way more engaged in city government. I have a monthly meeting with the city manager and the mayor to discuss issues as they come. We review all, I don't know, it was 118 pages last year was the city budget, and we read every single page and reviewed it back and proposed different ways that the city manager could avoid raising taxes, and they looked and they listened and they didn't raise taxes.
Mm.
Not on everything. It was specifically property taxes that year.
Right.
Taxes are part of life. As much as people don't love to pay them, I think you and I both like that if we had to call 911, someone would show up. Our roads are paved. We have school systems. All of that happens because taxation. So we understand taxes happen, but we don't want people to be or heavily burdened by taxes that are unnecessary. So we really look closely at the budget every year when it comes out to make sure.
So is this one of those places where the work that you're doing on behalf of business, but it's also sort of benefiting individuals?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly it, right? So we look at the budget because we're charged to do that. It's part of our priorities. But when we find issues that are going to affect the community and we can find ways around it, we will gladly sit. We talk to assembly members. We talk to the city manager. We talk to the finance director. We will explain to them our side of things. And luckily, this last time around, they listened. So, yes, we are working for the business community, but we are glad to know that the benefits went throughout the whole community.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I know that's one of the big areas, but let's move to some tricky ones here terms of infrastructure. This has been a huge discussion over the last year, and I want to be mindful as we talk about these mm-hmm. because people have various opinions on these. And your board has set these priorities that you're looking at. So let's talk a little bit about what you're going to be looking at. First of all, I want to ask you, can you explain for those who don't know, what is the icebreaker?
So the Coast Guard is going to homeport an icebreaker here in Juneau. It's already been purchased. It was a commercial icebreaker that has been retrofitted. It is now named the Storis, and it will be here in Juneau.
Oh, wow.
So right next to where the fifth dock is going to be once Unitotum gets their permits, fingers crossed, they will have an icebreaker right there. And so an icebreaker is beneficial to the community because there's 300 sailors on an icebreaker. I think this one's a smaller icebreaker, so you won't see as many of them. But you have a lot of families, a lot of infrastructure that will have to come here. So we have a port that would have to finish being built out, which is great for our construction industry. A lot of uplands building, that's what they call it, because they have to build the infrastructure to support an actual icebreaker. All of the icebreakers.
What does the icebreaker do?
So they're Arctic mission ships. They break ice. They're
okay.
Literally, and so I don't think people realize we have two of them. I'm going to mess this up. There's two or three in the Coast Guard's fleet already. There's the Polar Star, and the Healy. And the Healy has come to Juneau the last 2 years and visited us.
Okay.
The Healy goes up to the Arctic, and it's full of sailors from the Coast Guard, but it's also full of scientists doing Arctic research.
Oh, interesting.
And the closest icebreakers we have in our fleet are all stationed in Seattle. And Senator Sullivan and the local delegation agreed that we should have one in Alaska. And luckily, they agreed that it should be here in Juneau.
So it'll be here, but then it will go up north?
Yep. So they go out on missions that are like 6 months at a time. So it won't be here all the time. But theoretically, their families might be here a chunk of the time.
Oh, I see.
So,
okay. Wow. Yeah. That's kind of interesting. So why is that a priority for you?
So the chamber.
The chamber, I should say. Not you necessarily, but you working as on behalf of the chamber.
So because there's things that will come with that, right? There are jobs that are created from the infrastructure that come with it. 300 families being added into our community would also benefit our businesses that have lacking. Like, have you ever gone to a restaurant on Tuesday and been the only person there? If we had better population, we wouldn't be the only people there. So it's to promote population. We also have demographic loss, which you see as part of our priorities or demographic trends. So young families are Coast Guard families.
I see.
So
okay.
It plays into other parts of our priorities, having
I see.
It.
Okay.
And we have a great relationship with the Coast Guard, our Chamber of Commerce. We have a liaison from the Coast Guard that comes to our meetings, and we try to have open communication because we want the business community to be able to support their efforts when needed.
Okay, I'm going to ask you maybe a tough question. So not everyone believes that growth is good, right? So some people are on the other side of the, it's not an argument, discussion. Yeah. Let's say discussion. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious in terms of like, is it always about growth when it comes to business? Or are you also doing work to sort of monitor the chamber? Is the chamber doing work to sort of monitor what is happening in our town and the effects that some of these things might actually have on the town?
So, Juno, we always want it to be a great place for people to work, live, and visit, right? That's a goal of the chamber. And I'm not talking about just increasing. We have a decreasing population in Juno, right? So even if we had all of these Coast Guards, even if every single one of them popped up to Juno, it probably would end up leveling itself out. We are losing people in Southeast Alaska. So it's funny. I got in an argument, not an argument, a lively discussion about this the other day. And I agree. I moved from Phoenix, Arizona to here. And the reason I love it is I'm never in traffic. If we had a million people move to Juno, we would have traffic and I would not love it. I don't want Juno to giantly grow at an exponential rate. I want there to be sustainable growth. I want us to know that in 10 years, we'll have enough people here still living, that our hospitals can take care of our aging population. It's not necessarily about getting bigger and better, but like we also have to look at just sustaining the demographic we have. We are having 1.2 children. We're not having the 1.2 children that we're supposed to have to replace our death rate here in this town. Mm. So eventually our demographics are going to shrink. So unless we have shining things on our horizon like development, like an icebreaker or other things, you're not going to get people to move here to replace the people who are leaving here or dying here.
Right. Okay. We're a little short on time. So I want to jump to, these are available for people to see on the website.
Yes. All if of you the go priorities. To Juno Chamber and you click on our advocacy tab, all of our priorities are always listed there.
But let's just mention a couple of the area-wide priorities, which was the third sort of main category. Is there one or two of those that you want to highlight quickly?
Yes, because they're beneficial to the community. So housing and development, we used to have our own committee here in Juno or in the chamber. Now the city has taken over that committee and I sit on it. We're an ad hoc committee and we are rewriting Title 49 to make it so developers want to develop land in Juno so housing can hopefully one day be affordable again.
The housing is a major issue here.
That's a huge community issue. And child care is another one. We're working with the university, the school district, AUIC. We're trying to get all of these people together to work on this huge issue that affects the entire community. Even if you don't have kids, you go to grocery stores, you go to restaurants, those people have kids, and you need them to have child care to have employees go to work.
So. Right, right. Yeah, it's really interesting because like that gets into the whole idea of like city planning, and I always think about those folks, the city planners, and how many, you know, you can play like a video game, like a Sim City, and you can kind of get a sense of like what that might be like to have to deal with all of those issues that pop up. But it is fascinating of even in a town of our size, which doesn't seem very big, there's a lot of complex things that all the systems and they have to play together to be able to work and to keep moving forward. So you can find all of these priorities from the Juno Chamber on their website and junochamber.com. And Maggie, I really appreciate you coming in and we'll see you next month and we'll talk more.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Boston. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, live music from The Forest That Never Sleeps, who will be in Juno this weekend for a concert, plus details on the Brain Reboot class beginning at Southeast Alaska Independent Living in February.
Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Ok Bay 91.7. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh, and have a glorious Juno evening.